So now I'm again that worker who just receives the message from his boss, well, sorry, I have to fire you, and I have no experience or no insights into what you are talking about. So maybe there are some enlightened people, yeah, so they somehow got it, yeah, but I definitely haven't got it. Yeah. So what to do?
Well, you have a practical problem, of course, so do your best to solve it. You have been fired, do your best to find a job, and you are not different. But your inner attitude could be very different if you knew that consciousness is universal instead of personal. That this universe is not your opponent, your foe, your enemy, but that you are one with it. And that if you are simply open to the possibility that consciousness is universal, and you keep that in your mind and in your heart, things are going to evolve in a different way, magically. And magically, life will find a solution for your problem. And that will always be the case in your life. And life will do that for you until you are completely convinced that consciousness is universal. Because that's how consciousness proves its universality. Through this magical quality of the cosmos. That's the experiential part of it, or the scientific part of it. You can call that miracles, but they are miracles not in necessarily in the sense that they are exceptions to the laws of physics, like Jesus walking on water. But there are miracles in the sense that when you are open to this possibility, then life takes turns through which the problems that have seemed to arise for you find their solutions. Either because you find the solution, you apply for a job, you get the job. Or, you apply for a job, you don't get the job, but your uncle in America passes away and leaves you an inheritance.
Now, but again, when I'm in that suffering state, and the suffering state itself seems to be an expression of not being open or aware that the consciousness is universal.
Yeah. So and we make a big deal in our societies, you know. I mean, our fathers who have lived through the war, you know, I mean, for them to lose a job wouldn't be a big deal compared to their experience, because even if you lose a job, you have public support, you will still be taken care of, and tomorrow there will be new jobs when the economy starts again. So we have to take all of that with a grain of salt, you see what I mean? It's not the end of the world, and it shouldn't be the end of happiness.
Okay, we did the job thing. Now let's go to another one, relationship. Huh?
Yeah.
So again, an example. Problems with the partner. Partner has some. Let's make an example. Feeling threatened or not understood by the partner, or threatened, having ideas that he has he wants to overrule me, or wants to, can even be terrorize me, or whatever might happen in these relationship dramas.
In that case, even if it is true, you are only terrorizing yourself, because you don't have to be in this relationship. There is freedom. I mean, it's a free country. So, if your partner terrorizes you, and if you still want to be with the partner, it is a self-inflicted pain. And, I mean, if that's what you enjoy, you know, it's a free country. You take your pleasure wherever you can.
Okay.
But I would say this about a relationship. It is important not to have a relationship with people, but to have a relationship with the consciousness in people. Knowing that the consciousness in them and the consciousness in you are the same. So you don't relate to people, but you speak directly to the consciousness in them. And when that happens, something magical takes place, because the consciousness in them recognizes when it is addressed, when you call him or when you call her, the consciousness, it resonates. When you have that in your heart, when you interact with people, when you are open as you interact with them to the possibility that the consciousness in them and the consciousness in you is the same consciousness, something happens. It's like people have an armor of defense.
Yes.
And when you do this, when you address the consciousness in them, it's like a jumping over the armor of defense, and then you are. It's like a child who jumps on your lap before you know it, and the child is there smiling at you, you see, and all your defenses are gone. You see? So that is this beauty in finding the child in people.
Can this be learned, or does it happen on itself when once the universal character of consciousness is clear? Is that the portal?
Yes, but you can try it, and you can try it, and you will see the truth of what I say. You try it, and then you adopt it. But it's like when I say you try it, it's like a Ferrari you had in the garage and you have never used. You see, and just I'm telling you, just go for a drive, test drive the Ferrari. Then later on, you may want. I would say this person, you may want someone to help you drive a Ferrari because it's not easy, and you may have someone who has driven such a car and give you a few hints, and that's the function of a spiritual teacher. But at the end of the day, it is your life, it is your experience, and it is for you to discover how the science of happiness works in your life.
So that sounds like a good remedy, just to say, okay, I meet people and I have exercise to meet them in the knowing or in an attitude of we are one consciousness.
Yeah, and you can even exercise that in the privacy of your bedroom. You have your chair in front of you, because your chair is not going to have negative thoughts about you.
Yes.
So the chair is a good start. And as you see your chair, you embrace your chair inside you. You see what I mean? You are bigger than your body. And you're in this huge body of awareness, you kind of hug the chair. Until it becomes natural for you that everything which is around you is in fact part of you.
It's in me, yeah?
Mm-hmm. It's in you, yes. And so you can practice this exercise, because then when you are in the presence of people, they will be in you, and if you feel them in you, somehow, they will feel that you feel them in you. You don't even have to talk, you see. There is something in them that will open, that will feel. You know, the first time I met my teacher, and I met him in Saint-Paul-de-Vence in the south of France. At the time I was living in Marseille, so on my way back home I had 300 kilometers to drive, and I had the time to reflect upon our meeting. And the thought that came to me was, I don't know whether he's a realized teacher, but I know that I would like him to be my friend.
Mm-hmm.
You see, there was this quality that I had liked about him. It was very natural, I felt comfortable in his presence. And it's because of this non-judgmental. If you see the consciousness in all beings, how can you judge yourself? I mean, you can judge them, but just as you would judge yourself, and that's not threatening.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are not judged as being higher or lower, you are judged like mm-hmm. you would be judging yourself. You say, oh, oops, I made a mistake. Yeah. Oh, oops, we make a mistake, you see here.
Yeah, I understand this, huh? So being in this openness to see everything is in me, I'm not really separate from that, and then embrace it basically in all encounters, and then this will happen automatically without judgments.
Yeah.
Or without
and doing it as an experiment, not
playing with it.
Playing with this possibility, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Because we cannot prove, based on phenomenal experience, we cannot prove anything about consciousness, as we discussed earlier on in Germany, with the metaphor of the astronomers and the pictures taken that couldn't give us any information on the age or on the gender of the astronomer. Anything that appears in consciousness cannot give us any information on the nature of consciousness, therefore cannot give us any clue as to whether the consciousness is separate and personal and limited, or whether it is universal. Based on phenomenal experience, we will never know. Nobody will ever know. It's impossible to know. So how are we going to find out? You see, and the way to find out is, let's say we have lived for 40 years based on the assumption that consciousness is private and limited. Why not, as an experiment, try to live for 3 months from the alternate possibility? You see what I mean? And see what it does for us. You see, and see what it does for us. That's why it's an experimental. Experimental science, and see what it does in terms of serendipitous events in your life, in terms of satisfying the desire of your mind for understanding, the desire of your heart for love, and the desire of your senses for beauty. You see, And my guess is, if you conduct the experiment, if anybody conducts this experiment for 3 months, I mean, before these 3 months, they will be completely convinced. You just have to conduct it.
For me, that makes a lot of sense what you say. I mean, any hints? Is there a book where that could accompany a person who tries to go that path, try to play with this assumption?
I have a book in German. The title is Ewigkeit Jetzt. I don't remember who is the publisher.
Yeah, this can be found on the internet, yeah.
Ewigkeit Jetzt, yeah.
That would be the recommendation to...
I don't know of any books by Jean Klein, but, you know, all the books, I mean, the Bhagavad Gita, the poem of Parmenides, the sermons of Wei Neng, the sixth patriarch of Zen, the Tao Te King, Meister Eckhart's Predictor. I mean, there are many books. The Ashtavakra Gita.
These are pointers towards what you suggest. Yeah, basically, anything practical that could accompany somebody who does that game. For example, when I came into contact with all this stuff, I had read a book written by a Jesuit person. His name is Franz Jalic, and he wrote an instruction how to meditate. It was a 10-step approach, contemplative stuff. And first he gave instructions, and then he has, for each step, he had some typical dialogues between a meditation teacher and the guy who meditates, addressing typical problems that might arise in that period. Yeah? Is there something comparable available for your suggestion to play with this embracing or with this assumption there is only one consciousness?
But these questions get debated and discussed during dialogues. That dialogue is the traditional initiation process. We have retreats during which, in addition to the dialogues, we have a meditation and a form of yoga or body approach, which comes from the Kashmirian Shivaist tradition. My teacher, Jean Klein, his teacher was an Advaita teacher in India, but then after that he studied also yoga and also the Kashmirian Shivaist tradition. So for the body aspect, there are all kinds of exercises. I mean, one book is the Vishnubhairava Tantra, but which describes exercises. But the book on its own is not sufficient because they need to be explained by a teacher.
Okay.
We have an upcoming retreat in Germany in Weyern in July, and the information can be found on the Advaita Meetup group.
Okay. And so basically you would then give an introduction and a first guidance during that retreat into that direction.
Yeah.
And after the retreat, you would be available for further dialogues, or how would it work? How do you work?
People,
or is it usually finished?
People come, and ask, you know, I have had a relationship with my teacher for 20 years. The difference was that after 2 years, I was pretty happy with my life. After 4 years, I was very happy. But it was a pleasure to be with him and in the company of like-minded people. For me, it was the best form of vacation I could think of, you know, to be with people who are interesting, artists, scientists, writers, homemakers, students, elderly, you know, all kinds, from all kinds of races and of parts of the world, and of all kinds of levels of wealth and experience. It was so beautiful and so enriching. My connection with my teacher stopped when he passed away. We have retreats here in California, and I come to Europe twice a year in the winter. I'll be in Paris actually, giving a retreat in French and in English, starting this December 17 until 23rd. Then I'll be in Barcelona January 8 to 15, I think, for a retreat in Spanish and French. And then in Florida, at the end of January, for a retreat in English.
So you're traveling a lot.
I go to Europe twice a year.
Yeah.
And most retreats are in South California, where I am here. Yeah.
Yeah.
And nice weather. It's sunny out there.
Oh, it's too.
Can you see?
It's too light. Yeah. Oh, now I see the cactus.
Yeah.
Oh, the flowers, the plants. Yeah.
Can you see the
yeah.
sky? It's blue.
I cannot see blue. I just can see white. It's a matter of the camera.
Sky is so blue. Yeah.
Okay. Another question regarding traumas. So there seem to be some deep injuries in people's, can be different things, I'm sure you know. They have strong grips on people. They are invisible often, it seems, because the pain related to them is too big that they can come up to consciousness. Is there a way of solving this with your approach or your proposal, suggestion to assume that the consciousness is universal? Will this be solved automatically with it, or is special treatment required, or is special treatment possible at all?
Yeah, the cause, the real cause of psychological suffering is our sense of separation.
Mm-hmm.
This sense of separation, this belief in separation, has to be eradicated first.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this belief in separation, once it's been eradicated through the experience of our eternal nature as love, as intelligence and splendor, that is the cure. The leftovers then will be dealt with, and we can facilitate this process by using skillful means. But the most important is to stop the bleeding first. It's like when the fire brigade arrives to a house which is on fire, the first thing they do, they turn off the gas.
Mm-hmm.
And they turn off the electrical, but mostly the gas, because
yes.
It doesn't make sense to try to put an end to the fire if the gas is still fueling the fire. So it's the same here. The most important is to liberate ourselves from the ignorance of our true nature, which is accomplished through the insight into our true nature. And then that which remains are the leftovers of the past. the imprint of ignorance in the body and in the mind. Now, since often in our childhood and early childhood, we have been exposed to ignorant parents or ignorant people around us, this exposure to ignorance may have left traces, and these traces are memorized both as thoughts and images, but also as contractions in the body, and these contractions have kind of become subconscious, and they are experienced as a feeling of discomfort, of depression, or sense of impending doom, fear, etc. And we usually don't want to look at this feeling. We constantly repress. We have this skeleton in the closet, and the skeleton wants to come out of the closet, but we push against the door to keep the door closed. So what we have to do is really to stop pushing to keep the door closed, so that all the skeletons can come out of the closet. But we don't need to go to the closet to look into the past, to do a search into the past. We only need to deal with problems as they arise. If I feel a feeling of sense of impending doom, then if I welcome it, this feeling will tell me the story. Also, you were referring to past trauma, and I know that sometimes you can directly connect a contraction in the body, a subconscious contraction, and images in the mind, to a traumatic event, like this child who was put for hours in a closet as a punishment, and at some point he couldn't bear it, and then he internalizes this contraction. But in most cases, we cannot trace it back to a specific traumatic event. I mean, I know Freud wanted to everything to be traced back to a traumatic event. No, because in most cases, in the presence of ignorance around us, at a very young age, we are like a virgin piece of paper, ready to receive the imprints of our surroundings. If we live with a mother who is depressed, she may mean well, but she's just depressed, and her face is always sad. Our face will become sad as a child. We will imitate mom, but if we imitate the sadness on her face, we will feel the sadness inside. Are you following me?
Yes.
And that is handed down to us.
Yes.
Not in one single traumatic event, but day after day through exposure. This is through exposure. But that also comes out at some point. But what is important before we do that is before we try to put off the fire, it's important to turn off the gas, which is accomplished by the understanding and the experience of our universal nature as consciousness. That puts an end to the most pernicious of all problems, which is the fear of death. The fear of death basically is the common ground of all the fears we have, the fear of absolute disappearance. As long as we have not dealt with the fear of death will keep generating all kinds of fears and desires.